sales win rates have plummeted to a mere 17%, and outdated technology and tedious manual processes are to blame. Meanwhile, managers lack the visibility they need to hold their teams accountable. But imagine a world in which these crippling issues are solved automatically. Revenue.io automates the most frustrating parts of sales so reps can focus on what they do best, selling. Completely automate pre-call research, logging conversation data in your CRM, writing post-conversation recap emails, and prioritized outreach. And as reps book more meetings and close more deals, managers gain the real-time insight they need to scale what's working across their entire team. Ready to say goodbye to tedious sales processes and watch your win rate soar? Head over to revenue.io to learn more.
When you've been at it a long time and you've gotten through the early terrible training about, you know, the five opening questions and the five ways to close and how you tighten the screws. And, you know, we all learned to sell like that. And we did it for a long time. And for a long time, the job of sales management has been just trying to keep the pressure on your people to do that. And the problem with it is that nobody really likes to sell like that. And when you do run into the few people that do like to sell like that, they're not the people you're going to invite to your next Sunday family barbecue. You know, they just tend to be jerks. So the really good people in selling, after a while, either quit or they carve out a position for themselves so they can sell like they want to sell.
Hi, friends. Welcome to the Sales Enablement Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Paul. Now, that was Scott Roy and Roy Witten, and they are the co-authors of a book titled Decision Intelligence Selling, Transform the Way Your People Sell. Now, they have this great paragraph in their book that says, quote, there is credible research that identifies the business activity that creates or destroys customer loyalty. And it's the way they, the buyer, are treated during the selling process. In other words, the buying experience, it creates or destroys customer loyalty. Now, their conclusion, Scott and Roy, is that if you want to create a business that not only survives but thrives, then you really need to take a look at the way your business sells. So this episode and the two that follow it this week are all about attacking the status quo in sales. You know, despite all the talk about the revolution that has hit sales in the past 10 years, nothing could be further from the truth. Sales is still stuck in the past, and all the technology in the world hasn't changed that. So what I dig into with Scott and Roy is what companies need to do to really transform their selling. And they put forward their formula, what they call the RACE transformation equation. And we're going to get into that. And we'll also get into one of my favorite topics, which is what I believe is the wrong-headed belief many sellers have that selling is about persuasion, persuading people to buy stuff. You know, it's this belief that sales is about persuasion that drives reps, well, to sell before the time or sell before they really understand what the customer needs, which is so backwards and destructive of value. So we're going to get into all that and much, much more. But before we get to Roy and Scott, I want to remind you to subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to it. And if you subscribe, we'd certainly appreciate it if you'd give us your feedback on how we're doing in the form of a review. So thank you for that. All right, let's jump into it with Roy Witten and Scott Roy. Scott and Roy, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Good to be here with you, Andy.
And so tell us where you guys are sheltering in place. I know you're in separate locations.
Right. Well, this is Scott, and I'm in Knoxville, Tennessee, and been here for about 2 months now and separated from my wife and daughter who are over in London, England in our other home. So it's been a strange period of time.
I can imagine. But you're getting familiar with using Zoom, though.
Well, you know, it's really funny, Andy. Zoom is the platform that we use all the time anyway. I mean, I spend 6 to 8 hours a day on Zoom pre-COVID. Mm-hmm. Just because we work globally. We work all over the world. And, you know, speaking to our clients or speaking to prospective clients or our staff, you know, we're constantly using Zoom. So that's not been a big adjustment for us at all.
And Roy, how about you? Where are you?
I'm in Sacramento, California, and been indoors as well. I think they're starting, our 10th or 11th week here. My wife's here with me, and fortunately, our children and grandchildren are just doors away. We've all wound up on the same street.
Oh, wow,
so
nice.
So we do get to see our four grandchildren show up, keep their distance, play in the backyard, play in the driveway, and we're able to have some hangout time, which really makes this easier.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we've got kids just here in Manhattan, and we get together for socially distanced walks occasionally, but that's about it, right? So, yeah, life has changed.
Totally.
Indeed.
So tell us a little bit about the work you guys do, just to start off, because, yeah, you do some really interesting things, especially in other parts of the world.
Yeah, we're a sales consultancy. We've been going now, as I think this is our 12th year. We launched right at the height of the global financial crisis. So
always good timing. Yes,
always good timing. Well, actually, it was as a result of that, you know. And Roy and I were looking to join forces. We'd been working together, working for another consulting firm in London. And then this opportunity came together for he and I to work together, and you know, we've known each other for donkey's years, and so we basically are a sales consultancy. We have our roots in the commercial world in London and in Europe, and then for the last 10 years or so, we've actually worked all over the world in places like Cambodia and Zambia and South Africa and Brazil and 40 different countries like that, actually bringing our sales consulting, transformative sales consulting practice to organizations that that are selling very important products to the poor worldwide, things like water filters and latrines and things like this that are serving the poorest of the world.
Well, tell us about that. So, how do you get involved in that business, and who are the organizations that you're training how to sell?
Sure. Well, I mean that's a thanks for asking. I mean, it's completely by accident this all happened. I when I was turning 50 about 13 years ago, I'd retired and wasn't sure what I wanted to do for the rest of my life, the second half of my life, you know. And I was in London and working. Not working at all, but reading the Times every day because my wife was working. And I saw this article in the Times that said that they wanted CEOs that wanted to make between £2.30 and £5.10 per day. And it just caught my interest, you know, because I mean, a CEO making that kind of money. And it was all about a volunteer program similar right. to the Peace Corps, but for older folks called Voluntary Service Overseas. And so it just caught my eye. And I thought, wow, well, you know, why don't I look into this? And so I did, and I qualified for the program. And then I went to Cambodia to work as a livelihoods advisor for the program that was there. And so that's what took me into the developing world. And then from there, I learned that the selling skills and knowledge I'd accumulated over 30 years in the United States primarily, and then in London, actually worked beautifully in Cambodia. And, you know, selling very inexpensive packets of seeds and things like this, you know, to smallholder farmers. It's the same thing as, you know, closing multi-million pound deals in London. So,
very
so that's how it started. And then we got hot and, you know, it's taken us all over the planet.
Yeah. So, I mean, are these commercial organizations or are they like NGOs or both?
Yeah.
Or?
Sometimes it's NGOs. What basically happened about 15 to 18 years ago is that philanthropy and, you know, these organizations like USAID that give millions and millions, billions of dollars to poor countries used to just give this stuff away in the form of relief. And so what they decided about 15 years ago was, hey, you know, instead of just giving this away, why don't we, you know, the proverbial, why don't we teach a person to fish rather than just give them the fish? And so essentially, they began forming organizations that would then market these products to the poor. They would develop the products or market products to the poor. Things like solar lights that replaced kerosene lamps that are polluting, et cetera, or water filters, you know, where people die of diarrheal disease. It's a very simple fix if they just get their water filtered. So so these products and services are oftentimes, you know, $20 to $50 or $100 or maybe $200 that are very affordable, and they needed to build a sales organization or sales organizations to deliver this. So we work with NGOs, we work with private sector players, we work, you know, with organizations commonly known as social enterprises that are that have a social good and are also doing business, using business principles to actually build their influence and deliver the mission.
So how it's so fascinating when I was reading about this is so how do the concepts translate into something that, first of all, is you're selling something that's very everyday, right? You're talking about lighting, you're talking about, you know, sanitary facilities and so on, to people that, you know, don't have much to spend.
Right. Well, basically all of these products, I mean, these companies that are selling these products aren't trying to profit off of the poor.
Sure.
What they're trying to do is they're trying to be sustainable entities. So therefore they need to have some profit. And then, and what they're really trying to do is to create change in people's lives. They're trying to get people who have never used a bathroom, for example, to get them to use a bathroom. So it's not just selling the product, but it's also transforming their behavior.
Right,
which requires more than just a product pitch. And this is what I noticed when I got out there and I was starting to watch what people were doing, is they were just sort of pitching a product at people like a door-to-door salesman, you know, the typified door-to-door salesman does, you know, sort of, hey, you know, you need to buy this and here's why you need to buy it. Here are the features and benefits, et cetera.
Well, and when I or most salespeople.
Yeah, exactly. Untrained salespeople. And this is the point, is that they were just literally pitching at people and they weren't engaging in any sort of conversation. So, you know, this sort of fast-paced pitch really was a mismatch for what they were trying to do, which was getting people to buy into a different behavior. And so we took right out of our toolbox of all of the sort of complex selling skills and deeper consultative skills that we do, what we call DQ, or intelligence, that we were doing in central London. And we took it out and we put it into the rice fields of Cambodia. And actually that process, the four-step process, is exactly the same. It's just delivered in a much shorter period of time, like 20 minutes rather than 20 months. So, but the principles all apply.
People are people.
Yeah. And if you really want people to think deeply about the problem, that's the point. You want them to think deeply about the problem they have. Oftentimes people don't even know they have a set of problems. And so therefore you need to engage in conversation that helps draw that out of them so that they begin to realize that the problem they have is bigger than they thought it was. And so therefore it sets up an opportunity for them to, you know, to discuss solutions to that problem.
Mm-hmm. And sort of last question on that part is so how'd you guys make money on that?
Well, we make a lot less money on that. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Okay.
Than the rest of our business. We scale our rates so that it's affordable for organizations that are in places like the what we call the developing world or the global south is what it's now being called. Mm-hmm. And so we just charge a fraction of what we normally do in the Western world.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, it's so unusual because, yeah, on this show I talk to all these trainers and thought leaders and consultants, and it's you know, this never comes up, and you know, they're always concerned about, you know, what's happening here in the United States. And it's, you never get the sort of consideration about, yeah, what are other people doing? I mean, sure, certainly Europe, yeah. But I mean, as you said, in the developing world or global south is they have the same concerns. I mean, the scale might be different or the type of product might be different or could be the same. But yeah, we're so sort of Western-centric and Eurocentric in all that we do.
That's very true. It's very hard to see. It's very hard to see, life in Nigeria. I was just in Nigeria in the beginning of March, actually, just before they closed the country. and to work with, you know, people that are very, very poor farmers. And when you can show them how they can literally triple their income by being a part of this organization we were working with out there, it's to see the light on their faces. It's just amazing. But at the same time, the same process that we do in Nigeria is exactly the process we do mm-hmm. in South London or New York or, you know, with our commercial clients, because we also have our commercial clients as well. Yeah. And so, you know, it's the same process. It's the same quality of deep look into how people actually are transacting business and driving the sales within their companies, whether it's mission driven or it's, you know, purely commercially driven.
Well, I wanted to get in and talk about your book and decision intelligence or decision intelligence selling. You're adding another Q to the lexicon. There's, you know, EQ, and there's been a sales intelligence SQ. There's, I don't know, there's all sorts of RQ, relationship quotient. So now we get DQ, which, you know, could be Dairy Queen as well. My wife's a huge Dairy Queen. Those blizzards are very, every time we pass one, she wants to stop. She's very good about not. But before I talk about that, I just wanted to, I mean, it was a very smartly written book. You guys, you know, to my mind, get it in many ways that a lot of people don't. Is I just want to talk about sales improvement in general. And I just increasingly have this feeling that, you know, we're just attacking the problem in the wrong way. Mm. And, you know, we spend $20 billion a year in the United States on sales training. And billions more in sales technology, whether it's CRM or a whole new generation of sales tools that are out there. And yet the data is showing us that we really haven't moved the needle at all in terms of sales performance. In fact, the reports that are out say that maybe we've gone the opposite direction. And certainly when you look at overall increase in productivity across our economy, productivity is up just marginally, right? About 1.5% a year. So, and obviously some of that, you know, has to correlate to our selling ability. So, I was wondering what should we really change, right? I mean, I always think about this quote from Deming, Edward Deming, about every system is perfectly designed to get the results it gets.
Yep.
Which seems to be the rut we're stuck in sales, in spite of what has been this fairly dramatic changes. It's certainly driven by inside sales. We've got very specialized sales roles, you know, SDRs, BDRs, AEs, and so on, which, you know, makes a ton of sense in many situations. But it's like, yeah, it's just still not happening. Mm-hmm. And it seems like we put all this $20 billion into a very small return.
I think you're exactly right, Andy. This is Roy. And one of the things that we've really benefited from is our immersion into what's called transformative science or transformative learning and change. And when you apply the insights of transformative science to the very things you're mentioning, what you find is that there's two fundamental reasons that things aren't changing in the world of sales, whether it's in the commercial world that we've sold in or also in the what's been called the developing world of social entrepreneurs that Scott has just been talking about. Mm-hmm. And the two things are, first, what people actually think selling is. That is what transformative science calls the paradigm.
Sure.
Which is like, it's like the one question fish never ask each other is, where's the water? You know, they don't know they're in water because that's how they live. There is the paradigm of selling that we've noticed is that if you look at the way that companies sell, the way people prepare, sales reps prepare to sell, the way they conduct themselves, what they do when the pressure's on and they're near the end of the quarter, they're not hitting their targets. You look at what they actually do. What you find is that commercial world people sell the same way that Scott described the developing world people selling, which is a view of selling that selling is fundamentally trying to persuade people to buy something. especially if they don't want or need it. You know, the old saying, you could sell ice to Eskimos. It's like that's supposed to be a good thing. And, you know, this view of selling, that it's fundamentally about convincing people to buy, that is one of the reasons that things aren't working. And this is why we've developed decision intelligent selling, that what DQ selling is about is not trying to convince the customer to buy. It is leading the customer to improve their decision intelligence, their DQ, so that they can make the best possible decision for their business. And if, as a salesperson, if you can do that and refuse to maneuver, persuade, cajole, and instead focus on helping your client really make the best possible decision by raising what we call their DQ, their decision intelligence, even if that client doesn't buy from you today, they're going to be back tomorrow, and they're going to be back with a few friends. And so to shift selling, you first need to have a different frame of mind about it. And then the second thing is you need to know how to transform yourself, and as a sales leader, transform your people in order to sell that way instead of the old habitual ways to go about this that we're all locked into.
Yeah, and I want to dig into both those, but I was sort of thinking more broadly in terms of what has to change. Is, you know, one of the things that in this Deming quote, I've been reading this book Upstream by Heath, and it's just like, okay, yeah, are we not approaching even how we analyze what the problem is from the right perspective? Because, yeah, a lot of data exists that says that perhaps one of the most important way you can try to affect individual seller performance is through more effective coaching. And yet we invest no money at all virtually in trying to train people how to coach. You know, even with the methodology you lay out, with your RACE methodology, is somebody still needs to coach that, right? And so I think, you know, I was thinking the other day as I was having this conversation with someone, is like, well, maybe we've got it all backwards. Yeah, you know, maybe what we need to do, and I'm just by way of background, I'm a huge soccer fan. And so, you know, Liverpool fan and so on. I love Premier League soccer. But you look at the way they've structured how they manage and coach those teams. And it's not just soccer, but professional sports in general. They have these roster, very specialized coaches with, you know, specific knowledge about performance improvement, mindset improvements, you know, nutrition, health, you know, even the point of Liverpool's got a coach just for throw-ins, right? Mm-hmm. Is we don't do anything analogous to that in sales. You know, we still assume that the VP of sales and his small cadre of team are experts on all this stuff, which they're not.
Nope, they're not. And that's one of the big mistakes companies make, is trying to hire that expertise instead of learn how to develop it and then train their people in it. Mm-hmm.
But do we have to like change the structure of how we manage sales? I mean, I look on the sales side and I said, you know, we've made some pretty radical transitions and that are sweeping through sales with the specialized sales roles. Yet we still fundamentally manage sales the way we did 120 years ago. You know, we still imbue this, you know, these mythical managers, you know, thinking that, you know, hey, they are the end all be all of knowledge about sales. And they feel oftentimes, you know, VPs, and maybe you've seen this in your business, I certainly did in mine when I was doing more consulting, was last thing in the world a VP would do is raise their hand and say they need help, because that was a sign of weakness.
Mm-hmm.
Such a good point. You know, the real job of sales management is to do exactly what you're describing, which is, first of all, to design a selling system that raises the DQ of their clients instead of just tries to persuade them to buy. And then secondly, they need to know how to literally transform their people, not just how to coach them in general, but how to help them shift. You mentioned the form transformative formula we use, R equals A plus C plus E. which means that if you're going to really transform somebody, you've got to go after three things: their attitude, their competence, and the way they execute. Right. And you've got to do it in a holistic fashion. And it starts with transforming and giving people the ability to literally recognize their mindset and shift it, not wait for it to shift, but shift it themselves. That is part of the magic sauce.
Right.
And if you, as a sales manager, you can learn to do that, you are going to be able to build people in a way that you never could before.
But my point is, why should a sales manager be the person to do that? Why shouldn't there be a coach that's a mind, we'll call it a mindset coach or a transformation coach on staff? And that's all they do. Mm-hmm. Let the manager manage, you know, the developing the capacity of the organization and, you know, hiring and putting the right process in place. Mm-hmm. But when we develop individuals, why don't we imitate what professional sports are doing, which is a performance activity, just like sales is a performance-based activity? Mm-hmm. Why should that be a sales manager response? Why shouldn't that just be, that's a staff position? This is a person, this is what they do. They coach, you know, this aspect, you know, say of the attitude that you talked about. Mm-hmm. They're the attitude coach.
Part of it's function of numbers. You got one coach and all these people out there whose attitude is slipping and sliding all over the place.
Well, especially
when they're on the job. And therefore, the way to really make it sustainable is show the manager how to do that.
Well, sure.
We happen to think that's the manager's job. Because if you really want to build your people's capacity, learn how to help them manage their attitude.
Exactly. But my point is, I think it's become so special. The knowledge to really make it happen is so specialized that we shouldn't have the managers do it. We should staff up these positions. I said using pro teams as sports teams as a comparison.
Sure, sure.
These specialized roles. And I just see this, there's a reluctance somewhere, either at the C level or whatever, to say, change their mindset about, you know, we're so archaic in the way we try to manage sales. It's mind-blowing.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do, Andy, with you know, the actual channel structure you have and, you know, what is the product you're selling, et cetera, because, you're not always following, you know, certainly not following the same distribution system. Mm-hmm. You know, some companies might really benefit from having specialists in those areas. You know, so you've got geographic concerns, you've got, you know, all these various different things that are going to be a matrix of different decisions to make. And maybe you do have several managers who are involved in this or several people that have specialties. Whereas another product that you're selling or a service you're selling might not require that kind of specialization. So, I agree with you that, you know, in the right situations, maybe it does make sense to have that sort of specialty.
Can I add a thought to that, Andy?
Sure, absolutely.
One of the things we've noticed, because we face this with every client that we work with, and we often do find kind of attitude management champions, people who get really good at this within a given company, and they kind of take on that role that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And it's very valuable, and I wouldn't slight it, and I think that is something to learn from professional sports.
Yeah,
the reason, however, to really get managers to be good at it, and in fact, we require our own managers to be masters at doing that, or they can't manage. The reason is that managers can screw things up faster for a sales team than the management coach can get to them to help fix it. Mm. You know, managers with one email or one one-to-one conversation or the way they set targets or the way they jerk people around in targets or they can do more damage in 5 minutes than one attitude coach just can't be there to fix it. So we think that what's needed is a transformation in management. Attitude coaches would be helpful with it. But well, I think it's time for managers to learn how to manage attitude.
Well, okay. I mean, so we can take my analogy of the sports teams. You know, if you want to become the manager of a Premier League soccer team, there's what, four different coaching certificates you need to have? A through D or A through E even, something like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got to go through some serious training. You know, I find it interesting, and I've posed this question to other people. I'd be interested in your response to this. Is so if we took that $20 billion a year in training that we spend on sales training in the United States, of which maybe, I'll say generously say, 5% of it is spent on training managers, and I don't think it's that much. I mean, I interviewing an author a couple weeks ago, and he said that there was a study he quoted that showed that, at least in the U.S., is, you know, the average age a manager is at when he gets his first leadership, or he or she get their first leadership training?
Yeah.
Age 42.
Wow.
So what if we took this $20 billion and flipped it on its head and spent, you know, 18 of the billion training managers and 2 billion training salespeople?
Well, this is really interesting. Scott, you want to speak to that about our latest insights about how we're training?
Definitely. I mean, you're really speaking my language here, Andy, because as you know, as sales consultants, you know, we go into organizations and they're, you know, we're not there because they're doing well. We're there because they have a problem and they can't fix it for themselves. And so, you know, generally speaking, we can do all the fixing at the sales rep level and get the systems right and everything. But if management fundamentally is not aligned with that and supporting that and creating the context for that, then we've just wasted our time. We've wasted their money to do that. So number one for us always is to absolutely be sure that when we get in with a client, is the number one person we got to get on board is the person who is the leader, to make sure that they realize it's their sales transformation and they're leading it. We're supporting in it. We're going to do the hard work, but they've got to lead it. And then secondly, we need to work with the management team to get them right before we can actually begin working with the sales team. You see, because the managers are the ones who are going to be the ones who are going to actually create the framework or support the framework and then transform how they're actually working with their people. So I couldn't agree more with you. I think it's a great point you're making.
Yeah, and not to belabor it, because it's a conversation I'm trying to have more and more in the industry. It's just like,
yeah, totally.
And it's relating to this Deming's quote, right? It's, you know, we get the results we deserve basically by the system we have. Everybody's like, well, we've got, you know, our typical Pareto distribution and the sales results like 80-20. It's like, yeah, but we set it up that way. It doesn't have to be that way. Not every system falls to an 80-20. We designed it that way. To a point Roy was making before is, you know, uneven treatment of sales reps, all these other things that go on. So, yeah, we need to change that particular paradigm. And I know you guys love talking about paradigms, but to move on from that, I want to go back to a point, Roy, you had made earlier, which so few people talk about. I talk about it. It's nice to see other people talk about it. Is that sales is not about persuasion or convincing. Mm-hmm. And it's about helping somebody make a good decision. Mm-hmm. And this is I think, to your point in the book and what you're talking about, such a fundamental shift in attitude or mindset or whatever you want to call it, that I think pervade sales is people are fundamentally confused about what their mission is.
Hmm. Well, I think you've got it right on the nose, Andy. You know, you've been selling for what, 40 years?
Well, if you have to say it publicly, yeah.
Sorry, we're talking old folks.
I just got outed here, but yeah, go ahead.
I'm 42 years myself, so I guess.
I'm on to 50 something, so we're talking among generational equals here. When you've been at it a long time, and you've gotten through the early terrible training about, you know, the five opening questions and the five ways to close and how you tighten the screws. And, you know, we all learned to sell like that. And, you know, and we did it for a long time. And for a long time, the job of sales management has been just trying to keep the pressure on your people to do that. And the problem with it is that nobody really likes to sell like that.
No.
And when you do run into the few people that do like to sell like that, they're not the people you're going to invite to your next Sunday family barbecue. You know, they just tend to be jerks. And so the really good people in selling, after a while, either quit or they carve out a position for themselves so they can sell like they want to sell. Mm. But imagine if when a company just takes that on as a company and says, we are not going to sell like this anymore. We're not going to sell as if it's all about convincing the customer to buy. Once they get that at the top, then all sorts of things begin to change. You know, just one example. Mm-hmm. We're working for a large multinational telecommunications company. And I was sitting down with the guy that was in charge of the whole software system and the training system that took all of their sales reps through what they needed to do before they ever talked to a customer. And there was a whole bunch of computer screens they had to work through. They couldn't jump screens. They had to stay with what they were doing. They had to develop, you know, a cost-benefit analysis, a risk analysis, at least three value propositions, comb through their products and services, pick the five that looked like they could work, develop a pitch for each one, three PowerPoint decks before they even went and talked to anybody.
As a first call, you mean before they've made
make the first call, yeah. Now, you're familiar with that with your background, and that is all because everybody thinks that this is what selling's about. Showing up and establishing your credibility and your trustworthiness by showing how much you know and what the benefits your client can get and pitching them. It's all about pitching. And once you get that is not a way to sell, but it's about raising the client's DQ, that all gets turned on its head.
But we're in this phase, though, mm-hmm. in sales, especially in software as a service mm-hmm. companies, where it is all about first call, let's set up a demo.
Mm-hmm. And you know, the problem is that everybody thinks selling's about pitching, including the client. So they ask for a demo. They expect you to show up with it.
Right. It's gotten worse, is my point. Yeah. Again, back to the Deming quote, is we've created these systems, especially in the SaaS world, where they function on low win rates, and it's all about volume through the funnel, velocity through the funnel, and there are two problems. Well, there are multiple problems with that, but one is the two point you made earlier is that these systems they've implemented are all about compliance because it's about the process dominates. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we want people who are going to sell according to this process, mm-hmm. and we don't give people as much of an opportunity to develop their individual strengths, right? To become the best version of themselves. Mm-hmm. The way that I was given the rope to when I was coming up. Making 30, 40 cold calls a day. I was out in the field making that many cold calls the first number of years I was selling. Mm-hmm. But I had the freedom to do it within our system to the way that fit my skills. And I wasn't like everybody mm-hmm. else. I've told the story numerous times here about after the first sales training, I worked for Burroughs. You guys both remember Burroughs.
Sure. You had a great sales training program.
Sure. And I got back from my first 2-week sales training class, and the recommendation from the instructor was they should fire me.
Why? What was based on what?
Because I was too analytical. Because everybody else in the class was, hey, how you doing? Right? Glad hand. And that wasn't me from personality standpoint or inclination at all.
Yeah.
But throughout my entire career, I've carved out a way to sell that aligned with and successfully with a way that it comported with who I was as an individual. But it seems like we're sort of getting away from that, and it's harder, harder for people to do it.
There's some good news on the horizon. The good news are the people that Scott has worked with on our behalf in the developing world, the social entrepreneurs, who trust the value of a for-profit business and developing the innovation behind it, but who also don't want to do it simply for profit, but want to do it for the public good. And that is now, just recently, I'm sure you caught last August, the Business Roundtable, the 180-some top executives in the U.S., and every year they issue mm-hmm. forth stuff about purpose of a business. And in August of last year, their contribution to what the purpose of a business is eliminated short-term profitability from the list. And their list in first place was the well-being of their clients, and then their employees, then their suppliers, then the communities in which they work, and lastly was not short-term profit, but long-term profit for stakeholders. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was the first time I'd ever heard corporate anybody, corporate America, corporate Europe, come down and say, what we're doing is not working. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you. It's gotten worse instead of better as as businesses are chasing short-term profits to satisfy the streets. The companies, the commercial companies we've worked with are just suffering under this. Mm-hmm. They're losing good people right and left because they don't want to work like this.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's getting worse, but I think it's like COVID, you know, it's pushing it to a breaking point. Mm-hmm. And I think with that announcement from the Business Roundtable, with the social entrepreneurs we see who are always a few years ahead of corporate, I think we're coming to a point where people are saying, look, what we're doing isn't working. And if you're going to change it, you got to do two things. The first is you've got to go to the fundamental of what is selling. Mm-hmm. It's about DQ, not about persuading them to buy. And the second thing is you got to get good at transforming the human being and realize that the reason people take $20 billion worth of sales training a year and don't change is they spend a lot of time on autopilot. They spend a lot of time doing things the way they've done them before, and they don't know how to get out of that rut.
And their leaders and the leaders of these companies, you know, Andy, they really just, you know, they may say, look, we got to stop selling this way. But oftentimes they don't know what to change to, you know, it's and that's the fear. You know, it's like, yeah, let's keep doing more of the same that we know doesn't really work that well, but we don't really see an alternative to it. You say,
if we just change the structure a little bit or change the pitch or.
Well, yeah, that's why.
Change the software, you know.
Right. That's why we were talking earlier about let's make radical changes to this, right? Yeah. It's because we're just trying to fix it around the edges, and you know it's not working. It hasn't worked for a long time, and I
that's one of the things that I love about working with a lot of the younger companies we get to work with, because they've got younger executives. They're not so set in their ways, et cetera, you know, and so, you know, they're very open to new and different ways of going about something. And so therefore, we've had some great successes with that, and true in the commercial world, too. But oftentimes it takes a very visionary leader. And I'm sure you saw that in the book with some of the stories that were in there about people we've worked with, is that kind of visionary leader that says, look, I am tired of it being this way and I do want to mm-hmm. change. And so therefore they, you know, they put in place the protection to protect the teams and, you know, and shield them from other departments or other leadership that wants them to snap back into doing it the old way, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think we're in very interesting times. I think COVID is going to play a very big role in really shaking companies up and get them to think differently. You know, certainly the ones that are relying on, you know, face-to-face visits with customers and live and in person, you know, that's shaking those folks up quite a bit.
It's going to be a big change.
Hopefully there'll be a big enough change that we'll get some people to really begin thinking differently about what selling really is. And, you know, it's not just the lip service of saying, oh, you know, we want to make sure clients make the very best possible decision, you know, for themselves, their family or their business or whatever. We really mean it, you know.
Yeah.
It's saying, you know, and I tell you, when I learned how to start doing this about 20 years ago, As a professional salesperson and sales manager, when I learned how to do this, all of a sudden selling became easier, dramatically easier,
yes,
and more fun and less stress and all of that. And
it becomes simpler.
It becomes simpler.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's really the key.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we're running out of time. And so we'll definitely have to have back and talk about your book, because we really haven't touched on the book. And it is a very smartly written book. And I want people to be exposed to it. So we'll make sure I have you back before too long to talk about that. But in the meantime, tell people how they can connect with you and learn more about what you're doing.
Great. Yeah. Well, the best way to get a hold of us is at our website is www.wrpartnership.com. And you can write an email to contact@info@wrpartnership.com. And we'll be happy to have a chat with you.
Perfect.
And the book you're mentioning will be out in the fall. And between now and then, if they go to the website, there's a little e-booklet we've just written about part of how to make an attitude shift happen in the face of the COVID pandemic. And that's available now. And it's actually, you can get it for just a couple of bucks on Amazon, or you can get it for free by going to the website and getting a link to a distributor called BookFunnel. It's something we put together in the last few weeks just to help people through the pandemic.
Perfect. All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. And like I said, I look forward to talking again shortly.
Thanks, Andy. Look forward to it. Thanks so much.
Nice to meet you.
Okay, friends, that's it for this episode. First of all, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen. So grateful for your support of the show. And I want to thank Roy Whitten and Scott Roy for sharing their insights with us today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to this podcast, Sales Enablement with Andy Paul, on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you could also leave us a rating or review and let us know how we're doing, well, we'd certainly appreciate that too. You can do all that on your phone in less than a minute as soon as this podcast is over. So thank you for your help. And thank you so much for investing your time with us today. Until next time, I'm your host, Andy Paul. Good selling, everyone.
Hey, sales strategists. At Revenue.io, we're not just imagining the future of sales, we're building it. We offer the world's most complete platform for revenue teams, and we're featured in the most recent Forrester Waves for both sales engagement and conversation intelligence. With Revenue.io, you can slash call prep time to seconds, guide your reps in real time to have more successful conversations, and after calls, we generate ready-to-send recap emails so sellers can keep deals soaring toward the finish line at light speed. See the future of sales now at Revenue.io.